to me, it's natural to use sci-fi as a lens to understand issues of statecraft.
Sci-fi does a bit of an end run around that by allowing us to think about different futures, different warfighting concepts, different organizations.
It's just a great example of the fact that, you know, no strategy exists in isolation. There's a constant friction within the strategic environment that you have to work to overcome.
Welcome to The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sanisbert of the Mad Scientist team, and I'll be joined in just a moment by Luke Shabro, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the future of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can connect with us through Twitter at @ArmyMadSci or subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. On today's episode, we'll be talking with several authors of the book To Boldly Go, Leadership Strategy and Conflict in the 21st Century and Beyond. Major General Retired Mick Ryan of the Australian Army, U.S. Army Colonel John Klug, Dr. Kathleen McInnes, and Mr. Steve Leonard will be discussing the power and value of using science fiction in the military, what the U.S. Army can learn from outside perspectives, and the importance of strategic empathy as it relates to national security. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started.
Thanks, everybody, for coming on the podcast. Appreciate having everybody on. For Steve and John, you know, first, can you tell our audience a little bit about To Boldly Go, and what was the inspiration for creating this, and how did it all come together?
So let's start with the inspiration first. I think that's the easiest thing to do, because the inspiration ultimately drove everything that we did. The inspiration is a tired Australian man who spends a lot of time tweeting things he maybe regrets later, but who sat across the table from me at a dinner at West Point about, God, it's been 4 years now, probably, and said, mate, I have an idea. And it was a brilliant idea. And it was just a matter of then pulling things together so we could do it. Because if you look at science fiction has such a wealth of opportunity there to draw those threads of learning from different pieces of that genre and then bring them into a contemporary light and then look at issues. And it was simple. It was easy to do. The hardest part was pulling together such a terrific group of writers, but the inspiration was Mick. I mean, absolutely. It was his idea. Otherwise I would have sat at a table and told dirty jokes all night. He actually wanted to talk business, which is good. And then that's, you know, one of the reasons why we're here. And then after that, after the idea percolated for a while, then I found John, because John is never gamefully employed. He's a PhD ABD who blames me for the fact he can't finish his dissertation, because I always come up with stuff for him to do that gets in the way of actually doing any meaningful writing. And so I diverted him from writing his dissertation and said, hey, I got a better idea. Why don't we write a book? Why don't we work on a book and we'll do all this? And of course, John never tells me no, which is probably his greatest weakness in life. I think he's learned a lot from that. But John, do you want to add anything to that?
When Steve mentioned the idea, I was just excited, because science fiction is such a rich genre in so many ways, so many things that you can draw upon to talk about strategy, leadership. It was a wonderful idea, and I was very lucky and appreciate getting asked to help with the project.
We agree wholeheartedly about science fiction. We've had some of the science fiction authors in the book To Boldly Go have been on this show. Others are out in Hollywood and producing some of our favorite TV shows and movies that we've gotten to interview here and learn from them. But about the book, what kind of feedback have you gotten? Have you heard from people who've gained insights from the book or applied lessons from the book to their lives?
It's funny that you say that, because yes. And you know, you're never quite sure what to expect when you go into a project like this. You're not sure if it's going to resonate. We thought it was a good idea. I mean, obviously, between Mick, John, and me, we thought there was something really there of value that people would get from it. But you never know until it comes out and it starts to hit. And then you start to get not necessarily the direct feedback, but what I would call the side chatter. The people who are just talking about it, or you know, a little book club wants to get together and talk about the book. And then you realize that it really struck a nerve. And I read a review the other day that could have been written by one of us as we put this together, because it said something that was really meaningful. And that's that somebody who had picked up the book and read it, and then the more they read, the more curious they got, the more they watched on TV, the more they read, and it just sucked them right in, which is what the intent was all along, is that once you start to read, you're going to want to go watch an episode of Star Trek, or you're going to go want to go stream The Expanse, or, you know, maybe catch up on some old Battlestar Galactica, or pick up a book. It's just going to, it's going to suck you in and make you want to do that. Because we had that same experience, but you just don't know until it hits, that whether it's going to do that, whether it's going to achieve the outcomes that you want. Yeah, I mean, the outcome has been phenomenal and uniformly positive. I don't think anybody's had anything but positive things to say about it, which is great. I mean, it's encouraging, and it leads us to believe that there's a sequel here that we can work, and we're in the process of trying to do that right now.
No, I love it, and I think it's really fascinating, as Matt alluded to earlier, the authors that you brought in were just incredible. We had some who have been proclaimed Army Mad Scientists who have been on the program, and if I wasn't already a sci-fi fan and related to military interests all the time, I'd already be interested in just because of who you had writing in there. But what were the challenges like of bringing together kind of this diverse group of national security speakers and writers who aren't necessarily all in the same kind of wheelhouse, so to speak? They're from different occupational fields, maybe. How do you then translate all these ideas from this diverse group through this lens of science fiction and then add military relevance into that?
So there's a couple of answers to that. And I'm sure Mick and John will add to this too. So we had, I want to say, first of all, that we had some goals as we set into this, and based on previous projects and seeing some of the feedback from those projects, one of the things that we wanted to do was actually have a really diverse group of writers. And so from a personal level, we wanted a group of writers that matched at least gender-wise the population demographic of the country. And so we wanted at least half of the writers to be women. And I would joke that it was always fun to like reach out to a woman and go, "Hey, you like science fiction?" and get the old, "Oh God, a nerd, I'm not going to talk to you" kind of thing. That was the fear. And I think the only person who said that they didn't actually follow a lot of science fiction was Rita Konaev. But Rita was really cool about, "Hey, just give me some time and let me watch all of this show, and then I'll write something." Like, that's the attitude I like. And so that was the greatest challenge was, honestly, you can find a lot of guys out there, and I mean males, that are absolutely into science fiction. But finding people of the opposite gender from you that are as equally into science fiction and don't think you're weird for asking the question, that's a little tougher. And that was more of a stretch, and it required a much deeper network approach to things. But yeah, that was really the biggest challenge. Then after that, it was just standard editorial stuff. How do you get people to deliver a product on time? And we were generally really pleased. I mean, most people, when you have somebody writing of the caliber of Kathleen, the first thing that comes across the desk is a finished product that requires no editing. And that's, oh my God, that is like a gift from God, especially when you have to do all your editing through the holiday season. Do you want to sacrifice your Christmas and New Year's to edit? Well, guess what? You're going to. And so people like Kathleen or Mick or John, you know, I mean, those guys, they're lifesavers in terms of the professional thinkers, professional writers and communicators who produce a first-rate product on the first cut, and those people were absolute godsends and got us through some of the biggest challenges that we had.
No, absolutely, and it's a great segue to say, you know, Kathleen is a prominent writer and figure in the national security community. Kathleen, what was the process like for you transitioning from writing a fictional novel in the heart of war to really focusing more on an analysis of Ender's Game through this national security lens?
It's an interesting question. And by the way, thank you for having us on here today. This is just a lot of fun. And I should say that I'm here in my personal capacity. I'm not representing the United States government and, you know, all the standard caveats, right? But in terms of a transition, there wasn't a transition because I've been doing both of those sorts of things at the same time, right? To take a step back, When I left the Pentagon circa 2010, I had this idea to write a book about the experience of women in the Pentagon. And it was going to be this collection of stories of pathbreaking women like Michelle Flournoy. I was going to interview them. I had this plan in my head, but then I actually got a chance to start writing in about 2013 when I was in London and I was starting to work on my PhD. And it occurred to me at that time that I wanted a work that would resonate with people outside the Beltway and that would really communicate to folks like my mom and my best friend, Kristen, what it was like to work in the Pentagon as a woman, right? And so the exercise became, it turned into one, a project about writing fiction. And the process of getting into the creative space, understanding a creative analytic process, like building out what that was, sort of also turned on for me this notion that in terms of building your own creative analytic process, it's not just about making your own creative analytic work and seeing how it shapes your brain. You can also use creative works as metaphors, analogies for issues of contemporary statecraft. This is the project that Charles Hill talks about in his fabulous book, Grand Strategies, Statecraft, Literature, Statecraft, and World Order. So he takes all these different works and shows how the artists at the different periods in time are reflecting different historical and statecraft themes. And so it's natural to use sci-fi as a lens to understand issues of statecraft, issues of strategy. Oddly enough, by the way, when I wrote The Heart of War, I was reading John Scalzi's Old Man's War constantly. Because the banter, Voight, he is absolutely inspired by John Perry in Old Man's War. So there's a lot of back and forth. I don't see these things as sequential. I mean, a creative analytic process is so critically important for us to develop as a national security community. And doing your own creative works is a key way to build that sort of muscle set, but also using works of fiction, works of literature, works of art as analytic prisms to better understand our world and play with the metaphor is also pretty important too. So again, to me, it was just sort of natural.
I love that answer. I think the transitive property, and I don't know if I'm using that right because I was terrible at math, but the transitive property of fiction and especially science fiction is so powerful, especially in the work that we do when we try to articulate certain ideas and translate them through other lenses so general audiences can understand them. So I think that's wonderful. Mick, I want to ask you, how has viewing science fiction as an Australian reader and listener and viewer given you a different vantage point than how Americans have traditionally looked at it? Have you noticed that kind of a difference?
G'day, Matt. Can I say right from the front, out of John, Steve and I, I'm the one who's done the least work on this project. So don't give me too much credit. It's been all Steve and John that's pulled this together. I was a bit afraid of you about 6-7 years ago when I came out as a sci-fi tragic, as a one star at that point. I was really worried that would be it for me. People would go, oh, he's admitting he likes sci-fi. He obviously isn't a good senior military leader. The response I got was exactly the opposite. It was astounding just how many people came out of the woodwork and said, hey, finally, someone's saying this is value to the military community and developing military leaders. For me, what Kathleen said really resonates. It's about honing the creativity and imagination of our leaders and planners. Military institutions aren't always, there are exceptions, but aren't always known for nurturing imagination, and sci-fi allows us to do that. And we ran an elective for 4 years at the college here just to do that with our students. About 25% of students participate in that at any one time. But the other thing too is, military organizations are bureaucratic. They have people who are protective of their institutions and rice bowls. Sci-fi does a bit of an end run around that by allowing us to think about different futures, different warfighting concepts, different organizations, and different ways of looking at the integration of humans and technology that don't threaten the current status quo, whilst also putting markers out there for how we can and should change.
I don't know what we're going to do on this podcast because I just love all of this so much that I can't contain myself. I love this discussion and I love being able to talk about science fiction so much that I'm really going to have to rein myself in so I can do a good job here. Kathleen, let's go back to you real quick and talk about your chapter in the book. Can you talk about strategic empathy a little bit and tell us how it fits into intelligence and national security? Kind of expand on that for us.
Sure. The chapter was inspired by, you know, this question of, you know, why are we having such a hard time understanding our adversaries or understanding the context in which we operate? And really useful book on strategic empathy came out. And so I started playing with that notion and laying it up against Ender's Game in this context. You know, the idea with strategic empathy is to figure out the way to get into the mind of your adversary. And so how do you do that? You get out, you develop a psychological concept of empathy, not sympathy, empathy, right? So you can put yourself in another person's mindset, getting out, talking to people, focusing the intelligence community, maybe less on quantities of data, but more focus on quality of analysis. But to me, as I was writing, the more important theme that emerged was actually knowing thyself. Right? If you're going to know another, you have to know yourself. And this is where I feel, you know, unfortunately, we in the United States, in the Beltway, we have a tendency to really have a hard time getting outside of ourselves, getting outside of our own mindset. And I would argue in a lot of instances, get ourselves dangerously close to what H.R. McMaster calls strategic narcissism, right? Where we begin to believe that our mindset is the mindset and that our actions are responsible for the turning of the world. And I think we saw this recently with the situation in Ukraine, unfortunately. You know, there were so many folks who could not imagine that Putin would go to war in Ukraine, because from a Western strategic mindset, it makes no sense whatsoever until you put yourself in Putin's mind. And again, I want to make it very, very clear. I am not a Russia expert. I'm just following what Russia experts are saying. And when they go into that mindset of a stable Ukraine, it is not necessarily the end game here. Right? A broken Ukraine very well may be the end game in Putin's mind. That takes strategic empathy and imagination to get ourselves out of our own space, out of our own heads, and start imagining what that consequence could be. And as a result, I mean, I very much hope that senior leaders are thinking very hard about the implications of that mindset for NATO's eastern flank. Right? If we could not imagine that Putin could go this far, we probably should just go ahead and start doing the scenario planning just in case that we have some ideas. I think that would be prudent and responsible to do, and not scaremongering, prudent. But in any case, to close the loop, strategic empathy is something that we really do need to actively cultivate. And I thought the Ender's Game and Old Man's War were really good at teasing out the two sides of that, knowing the other and knowing yourself.
No, I think those are excellent points, Kathleen, because one of our bosses talks about a lot is the idea that when you looked at the 9/11 commission report and you saw a failure of communication, a failure of integration, a failure of operation, all these things, but one of the biggest ones was failure of imagination. And without strategic empathy, we're a lot of times, as you said, of what General McMaster has referenced before in strategic narcissism, we're getting trapped in our own ideas. And I actually think sci-fi as a whole really helps to lend us that ability to step out of our everyday and start thinking as someone else or from that perspective.
Absolutely. It gives us this methodologically unbound space, right? And because you are in this universe that is inherently foreign, you have to put yourself in the mindset of these other characters and these other situations. And you have the space to creatively contemplate the different implications. Sci-fi is a fabulous space to begin exercising the muscles to tease out what those implications might be and getting yourself into that strategically empathetic mindset.
Yeah. And I think when we think about imagination, there's a big parallel there with creativity. And so that segues to my question for Steve, who's often known for Doctrine Man. And did your work as Doctrine Man lend to any kind of spark of creativity for this book, or was it all just generally the creative nature?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I would never give that entity any credit for this. It's like a It's a thing that exists in another world, but the creative spirit always exists. And, you know, I would consider myself a writer first, maybe a satirist second or third. So, you know, this book actually was an opportunity to return to my roots, where I've done up until the time I started to create cartoons, all I did was write. And I wrote on a regular basis and I published on a regular basis. This was an opportunity to give back to where I had been, where I wanted to be, because I feel like the written word expresses my own creativity a little bit better. And let's face it, this was right down my alley. I was the kid who, you know, in second grade would run home from school, you know, a mile just to catch the Star Trek reruns on the fourth channel we got, you know, back in those days. You know, we got a fourth channel and it ran all this stuff in syndications. If I get home in time, I could catch the end of the Munsters, watch Star Trek, maybe Twilight Zone, you know, before my parents would come home and kick me off the TV. And so this was an opportunity to get back to those roots and then pull it into a creative direction, which I'd never imagined doing before, which was just terrific. I was at home with this project and you know, this was a passion project. So, yeah, I mean, that's really, Dr. Man had very little to do with that other than it gives me an outlet to help market what we're doing. But otherwise, yeah, this was all us.
Nick, are you seeing any parallels between what you wrote in To Boldly Go and your new book, War Transformed, and what's going on right now between Russia and Ukraine?
I think part of why we all wrote in To Boldly Go is to prepare our minds for what we're seeing in Ukraine. And if I was to characterize it simply, it looks like the Ukrainians actually might have read To Boldly Go and the Russians didn't. The Ukrainians have outthought and outfought the Russians in the last 9 days. Now, how it will end up eventually is anyone's guess, and I don't think a Russian victory is a foregone conclusion. But certainly, my book, I only published literally 2 weeks ago, has large sections looking at both Russian and Chinese ways of thinking about war, some of the new Russian hypotheses on what might lead to success in military operations in the future, and to be quite frank, some of Gerasimov's ideas. And the ideas of active defense and other ideas are hypotheses that have not yet been proven in Ukraine. So, you know, the Russians have got some real problems, both from strategy development all the way down to tactics. And I've finished, and Kathleen's probably a better expert at this than me, but the heart of the problem is that Putin has engaged in what Friedman calls a delusional strategy, and all their operational and tactical challenges have flowed from that.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer, Mick. And I think it's very poignant that, you know, it looks very promising for the Ukrainians right now. But we have to remember that this is 9 days old and anything could happen as this war goes on and on. I want to open this up to the whole group and maybe we'll start with John, pull him back in. What science fiction novel would you say has defined your way of thinking about military operations and strategy the most, and why? And maybe we'll even open it up to not just science fiction novel, but any kind of science fiction comic, movie, TV show.
Well, when you talk about strategy and looking at it, military strategy, sometimes we joke about Milton Bradley strategy or something like, I have a strategy for when I go shopping, I always make right turns in the store. That's not what I'm talking about. So when we're talking about strategy, I think it'd have to be Dune. And the reason I say that is because the houses are essentially major powers, but they're interstellar powers. But the parallel is to me is always World War One or earlier European major powers. That's what they remind me of. And I suppose being called houses naturally plays into that. The other thing is the nostalgia of the 80s. I still like the 80s movie, which has its flaws, and I'm well aware of it. But the costumes remind me very much of that World War One kind of era. And I think the interplay there and some of the other very powerful, the Guild as a corporation, the Bene Gesserit as a non-state entity or non-planet entity or however you want to draw that out. But I think Dune in that way captures it. The other part of it is the wars are set over years. So you have to think in the different instruments, the intelligence pieces of it, the economic pieces of it. It all really fits together nicely. It's got guerrilla war going on early for 18 months with the Fremen and so forth. So that to me is probably the single most important novel as far as that. The other one I always like to mention is The Expanse, but that's got more to do with the mechanics of the solar system and the way space combat would work with the technology that we currently have, technology that actually has to obey Newton's laws until they get the alien technology. But yeah.
I love the answer of Doom because I think there's so much to take away in terms of sustainment. And as you said, those kind of urban or guerrilla operations, all sorts of stuff in there. That's an awesome answer.
So for me, this is an easy question. Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, and I actually use this as an example when I teach strategy to my students, because I don't think, for me, there was never a better example of the interaction that takes place within a strategic environment. And when you read the Foundation novels, the whole idea is, you know, you're working towards a goal, towards a future, an envisioned future, but there's constant interplay and, you know, constant friction within that environment that it's not just simply a matter of saying, I want to get from here to there and here's the things I have to do. You're constantly dealing with the interactions within that complex system. And I actually used that as an example this week in class that, you know, that no strategy exists by itself. There are other strategies that are occurring and going on at the same time. And then there's conflicts and goals. There's, you know, resource challenges. You know, everybody's trying to do their own thing. And that forces you to take a systems approach to strategy and understand that you're having to deal with that interplay. And if you read the Foundation novels, they walked you, you know, Asimov walks them through that. You know, every so often, Harry Seldon pops up and says, hey, you made it this far. Okay, that means you figured out the challenges that were required to overcome to get here. And it required events to work out a certain way. And it's just a great example of the fact that, you know, no strategy exists in isolation, that there's a constant friction within the strategic environment that you have to work to overcome. And for me, that made a great example. And like I said, it's one that I can continue to use today.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Kathleen, let's go down to you. I saw your answer in the chat, but you have to expand on it now.
So mine would be The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Not only because of its absurdities. And if you're in the building, if you're doing, you know, work in this field, like our world is filled with all sorts of absurdities, both at the abstract level and just how, you know, how to push a memo through the system. It's all bizarre. But also it's this wonderful reminder of how forces can work on you and you have no idea what's going on. You just sort of muddle through and do the best you can. And I just think it's great for that.
Okay, Mick, you're up.
I mean, I've read a lot of the canon that has already been discussed, but for me, I just keep going back to Old Man's War, and that's why I wrote about it. The books kind of go from the tactical team level of war and elevate as you go on all the way through to the grand galactic scale of strategy. It's a masterclass from an author who has no military background or any training or education in strategy. And it's also a masterclass on the ethical use of future technologies.
Those are great answers. We normally don't, as hosts, answer the questions, but I'm going to offer mine up because the question is really about, you know, how has it influenced my thinking about military operations. And I think the reimagining of Battlestar Galactica is probably the one, in my opinion, that did it the best, because it really did take a hard science fiction television show and it treated it like it was a straight up military drama almost. You know, the writing on that really tried to capture the realism of being in some kind of a military operation or being in the military. I thought they did a great job there.
See, mine's I always cheat these questions, but mine's a tie between Starship Troopers. And then I think I learned so much from that book in terms of leadership and military professional development. The book, that is, not the movie. I think that August Cole and Pete Singer's Ghost Fleet just really, really, really changed the way I thought about conventional military operations and a lot of the assumptions we were making.
So the next question will again open up to the whole group. What's the biggest takeaway from To Boldly Go and the science fiction genre that you want future national security professionals to keep in mind?
For me, what it tells us is imagination in military and national security organizations matters a lot. And at the same time, we have a whole new generation of new thinkers and new leaders that are coming through that I think portend something really exciting for our institutions.
Yeah, I would just add that what Mick said is really good. And it really is something that I would just emphasize as well. It draws from what Kathleen said about struggling with a failure of imagination. If there's one takeaway from this book, it is that imagination is such an important part of what we do as professionals. And you cannot be afraid to use your imagination. And as a leader, you cannot stifle people's imaginations. You've got to spur that creativity, that brilliance that resides in a lot of people and allow them the freedom of expression. And science fiction brings that out, and it brings that out in a really, in an entertaining way. And I would hope that anybody who reads this book would draw that lesson from it. It underscores everything that we do. It's about imagination.
Steve stole it, but Mick's earlier point about fear, about talking about science fiction in certain settings and certain cultures within the military, we all worry about those things. And to be able to use science fiction allows you to tap into things that they've both talked about, imagination, creativity, metaphor, thinking forward in time and questioning assumptions and thinking through the different future nature of combat. You know, we all assume that with hypersonics and this and that and everything, it's going to be so lethal and the war will be over in a day. Well, the Ukraine has kind of showed us maybe there's something more to that. But there are other topics that we could talk about. You know, wargaming is another one. Wargaming is enjoying a renaissance again in the military. And that's wonderful because it allows people to think creatively and to see how their ideas play out, especially with a living, breathing, thinking opponent or opponents. So if we're going to really grapple with 21st century problems, we cannot be afraid and limit ourselves. And it's not, I'm not saying science fiction or wargaming or anything like that is going to solve all of our problems, but we cannot be afraid to try new things.
What John said is, I 100% agree with. Fiction, creativity, creative tools we're a community that still does not appear to be comfortable with this side of our brains to think through problems of national security. With Heart of War, I did any number of book talks, and I remember being approached by a senior leader who said, well, I only read one fiction a year, and I decided to do yours this year because it was on Dave Barno's reading list. And I was like, you're limiting yourself. When you choose not to exercise that part of the brain, when you choose to cut yourself off from one of the most powerful tools we have ever had in the history of humanity, right? Storytelling and narrative is how we have always communicated truths to and meaning to each other since we've been cavemen around campfires, right? Why are we divorcing ourselves from this set of tools that help us understand our world and create meaning in our world? How can we possibly do strategy when we're taking the tools that help us understand how to be human and how to interact with other humans as if we take that toolkit and put it aside? So my plea to the national security world, and I hope that those reading To Boldly Go, that this message shines through when upon reading it, is that we need to embrace the creative tools that we have. We need to start finding ways to embrace that methodologically unbound space and designing strategy from there. Failure to do so, again, leads us to failures of imagination, failures of strategic empathy. And we can't spend our way through these problems anymore, right? We have to think our way through. So let's actually use our full brains, our full resources, and embrace the creative side of ourselves in order to do so.
I think those are really profound points and need to be taken on as we think about this, because as I pointed out with reading fiction, I read a lot of nonfiction and history and war history and even into the self-development genre and all these different books. But sometimes I just need fiction to be able to set myself apart from that real world setting. You only have one life, and so I can't experience life as, say, a Russian. I can't experience life as a African-American woman. I can't experience life as an alien race. So when you get to those levels of fiction, science fiction, it allows you to get an actual paradigm shift instead of thinking that we are thinking with strategic empathy. I want to give you guys an impossible question that we tend to ask everybody that comes on the podcast. And everybody always says it's probably the hardest question on the podcast. But and you don't have to answer as a sci-fi one just because of the topic. But what is your favorite movie?
So it's a relevant question because I just finished writing a short piece for my column on top 10 Cold War movies. And given the backdrop of what's happening in the Ukraine and the warming up of the Cold War again, this comes up. And the movie that I picked out as the top movie for right now was The Hunt for Red October, which has a good, strong science fiction thread to it when you talk about the military technological thriller from Tom Clancy, the whole Caterpillar drive and the most advanced Soviet screen and all the adventure and excitement that goes with that. But that is also one of my favorite movies, just in terms of the great quotes that you can pull from it. And if you go on Twitter today and say one ping only, please, everybody knows exactly what you're talking about. Or if you say, this business will get out of control. It'll get out of control and people will die. Everybody immediately knows what you're talking about, right? So that one, this week, today, is my favorite movie.
That was a movie directed by John McTiernan. And I was looking this up earlier because I don't think we realize how the like depth of hits he had from 1987 to 1990. He directed Predator, Die Hard, and then The Hunt for Red October. I mean, that's a stretch right there.
And I was going to say Predator, but I didn't want to scare anybody.
Could have put it right up there.
I'll go next. Predator is a great movie. Star Wars. It's got to be Star Wars. It is the movie. It is the universe that changed everything. I mean, literally everything. It had a massive impact, not just on cinema and how movies are made, but, you know, it changed how people think about good and bad, light and dark. And it's influenced every science fiction movie since 1977.
I think also it kind of saved the science fiction genre in film as a genre because they were back then they were looked at as kind of low budget. Nobody's going to go see them, make them for a little bit, a little bit of money. And then they saw how impactful it was. And now you have big budget sci-fi films, which we all enjoy.
I got to go after Mick, I think, because I think I've told Steve this. I may have mentioned it to other folks, but I saw Star Wars in the theater. It was my first movie, and everything else has been downhill ever since. That makes life hard. But all joking aside, for a minute, I thought about doing my top five just on quotes, right? So I'm shocked to find gambling going on here. You're winning, sir. that could be up there. There's so many, but I'll go back. I'll behave before I go into all the other ones. I think it's Empire. So I'm gonna argue with my good colleague Mick. I think Empire is my favorite. It's not the first, and all those things that Mick laid out make perfect sense. But as far as the story goes, I still think it's the best Star Wars movie. It's the middle chapter. It's the biggest reveal of all time. It really starts you to understand that first trilogy was about the redemption of Anakin Skywalker. And I always focus in on that. So I got to go Empire, but Raiders of the Lost Ark is always way up there. I could do a million quotes on that. I mentioned the Untouchables today on, for another good quote, what are you prepared to do? But I think maybe Predator was mentioned, more great quotes. We're all going to die. I don't know. Aliens might be mine. I don't know. If you're talking about science fiction, I might have to go with Aliens. So too many to choose from.
Yeah, I was going to say, way to nail it down there, John.
Mm-hmm. Empire.
Okay.
Empire.
We'll count it as Empire. One of the most amazing things about that is George Lucas, from what I've read, when he was at USC, was in a class with Irvin Kershner, who directed Empire. And I think that's one of the coolest things to be like a student – looking to your teacher and saying, you know, you're going to direct my sequel one day. That's got to be just out of this world.
I want to give a shout out real quick to Rogue One as well, because that was amazing. But so I actually agree with Mick. Like, it's Star Wars for me. But the movie that I've been thinking about a lot this week, I'm going to change the subject slightly. The movie I've been thinking a lot about this week is Hunger Games, and how that entire movie, like the way that society is structured to watch real-time violence, and how these media commentaries happen. It's just watching, we've been watching this war unfold in real time on Twitter. And the echoes of Suzanne Collins' work, to me, are quite extraordinary. And the implications of information war and controlling the narrative and the masterful job that the Ukrainians have done thus far. Again, I feel like Suzanne Collins' work anticipates that pretty well.
Thank you all so much for coming on. This is really a fantastic time to talk to you all. And we're seeing, as Steve alluded to, this kind of side chatter about the book all over the national security community and even outside that to the general public. So you guys did such a phenomenal job of putting together this amazing comparison and ideas.
I would just add that, first of all, thanks for having us. And I think thanks to Mick too, because I think it's probably the middle of the night there. And the fact that he would take the time out to do this is just, I'm forever grateful when he does these kinds of things, because I mean, it just speaks volumes to his character and what he's meant to all of us. But broadly, I mean, this was a passion project, and I think it's just the beginning of what's going to come next. And we're already working towards that right now. And I'm excited. Any opportunity to, you know, dig deep into something creative and have fun with it, and then give other people a voice as well. I think at the end of the day, you know, Mick, John, and I could have wrote a book and it would have been fine. But why not bring 30 of your friends along with you? And why not give them a voice? And why not just open the door to see what's possible? And the and that gave us an opportunity to do that. And you know, that also says a lot. And it also says a lot about who participated and who was part of this. And, you know, the people here, I mean, there's not enough gratitude in the world to express how much Mick, Kathleen, and John mean to me. And you know, on a personal level, on a professional level, just the great pride I feel just even seeing them, it just means everything to me. And I know I'm talking too long, guys, so I'm sorry, but, you know, thank you for being here. Thank you for having us. And hey, you know, I can't wait for the next one.
We really appreciate it, and we always welcome the chance to talk about sci-fi with smart people, and this was just an absolute privilege. Where can everybody follow you all at, whether it be Twitter, LinkedIn, that kind of stuff?
I'm on War in the Future is my Twitter handle, but I'm also at mickryan.com.au.
Yeah, I'm on Strategy Troll on Twitter. I'll leave it at that.
I'm the very imaginative KJ McInnes one on Twitter.
And anybody who wants to find me can find me, just Google Doctrine Man and it pops up somewhere. It's Instagram, it's Twitter, it's Facebook, you know, it's its own little entity.
All right. Well, fantastic. And thanks everybody again. And we look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks everyone. It's great to see you all.
Good night, Mick.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guests, Major General Retired Mick Ryan of the Australian Army, U.S. Army Colonel John Klug, Dr. Kathleen McInnes, and Mr. Steve Leonard for talking with us. You can connect with Mad Scientist through Twitter at @ArmyMadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to our blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps us to improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.